history nerds and historians. My name is Christina, and this is After History. This is where we talk about a little tidbit from history that's super fucked up. So this is now the third episode of my Tudor history series. So in the first episode, we talked about Catherine of Aragon and King Henry VIII's early life. And then the last episode, we talked about Anne Boleyn and how Henry came to be married to her and the downfall of their relationship. And I also did like a quick bonus episode where I read you some of the letters that Henry wrote to Anne between 1527 and 1528 during their courtship, because they're very interesting. So far, these stories have been sad and tragic, almost. Henry VIII was not the best husband. I mean, maybe at the beginning when he was married to Catherine of Aragon, he could have been. But from like 1525 on, he fucking sucked. So let's see today if he continues to suck. Spoiler, he does. So my intention was to talk about the next two wives of Henry VIII, because combined, these marriages lasted less than 2 years. And typically when you watch documentaries and the like on them, they're combined for this reason. A lot of their story is like relatively overlooked, sort of like, well, nothing really happened of note, so we can just mention them and move on to Catherine Howard, who's a little more scandalous and dramatic if we even talk about them at all. And a lot of time the focus is just on Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, and they're kind of like, yep, so he was married to Catherine, and then he divorced Catherine for Anne, who he later executed, and then he had four more wives and died. The end. But when I was researching Jane Seymour, who we'll be talking about today, there's so often like so little that's mentioned of her that I had a lot of questions, which led me into rabbit holes of research and going through primary sources from like letters and diaries and doing a full historical analysis on things that I could find about Jane Seymour during this time. And there's so much more that a lot of people don't talk about, which is why I'm sitting here 3 hours after this episode was intended to be published to y'all, drinking cold brew out of a wine glass, because who the hell are you to tell me I can't? So today we're talking only about Henry's third wife, Jane Seymour, and to stay on the schedule that I've made for myself to make sure that I can tell a pride-related story that I'm really excited about in June, I will release a second episode this week about Anne of Cleves, but honestly, I kind of like that better. Because like I said, because some of the later wives get so overlooked and they don't get their own attention, and like they don't get their own documentaries and like they don't get their own episodes of podcasts and stuff like that, I kind of like this better, because this is just sort of a way to highlight them individually and just talk about them. So that's what we're going to do. Trigger warning before we begin: death, traumatic childbirth, execution, miscarriage, and a little bit of child abandonment to just top it all off. So sit back, relax, and practice your, oh good God, what the fuck faces. So, Jane Seymour, like many of the other wives, is someone that we know very little about, unsurprisingly. There's not really anything from her that survives. There's not really much even about her that survives. She wasn't queen for long. She wasn't even actually coronated, so technically she was never officially crowned the queen. And I'm not gonna lie, she's probably the hardest one that I've researched so far. Like I said, it's just been rabbit hole after rabbit hole after rabbit hole, because there doesn't seem to be a lot about her, or like one source will talk about one specific thing and then another source will talk about another thing, but these sources aren't talking about the same things, or they're contradicting each other, and then I have to go and look deeper into it's been hard, but it's been really fun and really rewarding, and I really enjoyed learning about Jane Seymour. So she is often described as weak and submissive and meek and probably other words that end in eek. And in 1536, there was a portrait painted of her by Hans Holbein that people believe is relatively accurate. So according to that, she had a round face, a pointed chin, thin lips with like blonde hair or possibly strawberry blonde hair with bluish eyes. Yusa Shapley, the imperial ambassador, described her as, quote, middle stature and no great beauty, so fair that one would call her rather pale otherwise. She was described by a lot of people as being relatively plain, but that might just be in comparison to Henry VIII's other wives, who were regarded as being some of the most beautiful people that people had ever seen in their lives. So each wife had their own motto and crest that I forgot to mention for the last two. So Catherine's motto was humble and loyal, and her crest was a pomegranate with a crown. Anne's was the most happy, and her crest was a crowned falcon on a tree stump with red and white flowers. And then Jane Seymour's crest was a crowned phoenix rising out of a castle with red and white roses. And her motto was bound to obey and serve. And I just question, who was she obeying and serving? I know it's supposed to be like, obviously King Henry, Christina. And my dear Bartholomew, no, I have thoughts about her. Also, Bartholomew is back. Sorry if that's not your name, but that is like what I'm calling all my listeners now because I don't know who's listening. And if your name is Bartholomew, congratulations. Aren't you so very special? And also, you have a really cool name. Please don't ever go by Bart because that's terrible and it sounds like barf. So before we get into my thoughts about Jane Seymour and if she was actually a meek little lamb or like a badass tigress, let's go into her background and her life and everything that happened with Henry. So she was believed to have been born sometime between 1507 and 1509. A large biographer of her, Elizabeth Norton, believes that it was somewhere between October 1507 and early October 1508. She was described as kind and sweet and virtuous and honest. She was one of 10 children, the eldest daughter of one of 6 surviving children consisting of 3 brothers, which probably made Henry hopeful that like maybe she biologically inherited the ability to have sons because that's totally how it works. To be fair, they didn't understand the science of it back then. So, like, I cannot fully fault them on that. But it's just kind of interesting. And it's probably one of the reasons why he chose her. Because he was still just so desperate to have a son at this point. Reminder, he had had one daughter with Catherine of Aragon. And had one daughter with Anne Boleyn. With a slew of miscarriages of baby boys. Which there are theories about that maybe we'll talk about later on. Jane's father was a man named John Seymour. He fought in some wars with Henry VII and was knighted. He was a warden of the forest. He was a sheriff. He was a constable. He even attended to Henry VIII in his bedchamber at times. He also fought in France with Henry in the Battle of Spurs and all that. That was happening over in France while the Battle of Flodden was happening in England with Catherine of Aragon. And her mother was a woman named Marjorie Wentworth, who was a descendant of King Edward III, who is a monarch who ruled in the 1300s. Jane was most likely educated at home and not abroad, so she was a lot more common than Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, but that was, I mean, as the word connotes, common. Most women were not sent abroad for their education. Most women were not seen by expensive private tutors or sent to expensive schools. Most women were generally taught like very basic skills and were educated in more domestic matters of how to tend the home and how to be a good wife and all that. Some were taught to read. There is evidence that Jane was taught how to read and write, but that wasn't a large part of her education. And there are some other sources that say that she wasn't, that she only really knew how to sign her name and that there wasn't really much more that she could do. But again, Elizabeth Norton says that there's evidence about her being educated in how to read and write, and I'm going to believe her because she is a subject matter expert on Jane Seymour. It said that Jane enjoyed riding horses and attending hunts. Even when she was queen, she participated in these. She was said to be a great seamstress and embroiderer, and the work that she created was so good that even into the mid to late 1600s, it was on display before it was then gifted to her descendants. And she was very religious. Her family growing up were staunch Catholics, and she was raised the same, actually on the land that John Seymour oversaw as like sheriff and constable and all of that. I read that he had a resident priest until the 1530s when Henry broke with the Roman Catholic Church, and it kind of like became dangerous to have that, not just for the priest, but also for him and his family. So that's about all we know about her early life, is just some of her interests and education, because she wasn't this like grand, majestic member of the royal family. I mean, there's not much that was documented about her, because I don't think it was ever expected that she was going to be queen. It was probably expected that she was going to marry a lesser noble and just pump out a bunch of babies and just go on with her life, right? So her distant relative, Sir Francis Bryan, helped organize her becoming a lady-in-waiting for Catherine of Aragon, sometimes between 1527 and 1529, depending on what sources I read. Most say 1529, and she was very, very devoted to Catherine. Most likely, she wouldn't have been one of the women that was in close contact with Catherine at all times, because she was of that slightly lesser birth. But she, according to biographies that I've read, apparently really admired the queen, both for her strength and her religious convictions. And during this time, many historians of Steady Jane also say that she came to love and admire Princess Mary. Reminder that during this time period, she would have arrived at court. This was like the same time when Henry was pushing Catherine aside for Anne Boleyn, which might mean that Jane possibly didn't care for Anne Boleyn based on these alleged feelings for Catherine. I'm not in Jane's head, but speculating that that might have been the case. I did read in one source that honestly escapes me now, because there's so little that's written about her. I had to piece this episode together from like 1,006 different sources. But it mentioned briefly that when Catherine was forced to leave Henry VIII and was moved to Hertfordshire, that she may have been a lady for Princess Mary before becoming a lady for Anne Boleyn. But I couldn't find that confirmed anywhere else. According to Elizabeth Norton, there are no records of her, and it's assumed that Jane just went with Catherine to Hertfordshire. So I'm going to say that's probably not the case, that she was a lady waiting for Mary. But again, she did care for Mary, and she seems to have really supported Mary and didn't like how she was being treated by her father, which kind of comes into play later on. But this did not stop her from becoming a lady in waiting for Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn was actually her second cousin, but they like literally could not have been more different. And like we talked about the last episode, she had dark hair, dark complexion. She was outspoken and flirtatious. Jane, on the other hand, was blonde with pale skin, and she was relatively reserved and kind of quiet, and apparently was very chaste and very religious. But sometime within Anne's marriage to Henry, Jane Seymour caught his eye. It's not really known when. There is some evidence that kind of hints to maybe in October 1534. It's said that in that month, there was a woman who caught Henry's eye. She could have caught his eye when Anne was pregnant earlier in the year, because it was believed that it was bad for the baby to have sex during pregnancy. And we can't expect Henry to just like not make the beast with two backs for 9 months plus recovery. I mean, what a fucking nightmare. So on October 1534, Eustace Shapley wrote a letter that says that Anne may have sent this woman from court. So there's some people who believe that this woman may have been Jane Seymour, though historians like Elizabeth Norton believe that this might not have actually been Jane, that this might have just been a different mistress that was known only as the Imperial Lady, meaning that she was most likely Catholic and that she supported Princess Mary. But there are some people who do believe that this was Jane. This person was never named. So the letter from Eustace Shapley reads, quote, "Of late days, Lord Rochford's wife," which was George Boleyn's wife, so the sister-in-law of Anne Boleyn, "has been banished the court because she had conspired with the concubine to procure the withdrawal from court of the young lady whom the king has been accustomed to serve, whose influence increases daily, while that of the concubine diminishes, which has already abated a good deal of her insolence." I'll interject to say that this is probably because Anne had a miscarriage and Henry was a fucking dick about that. The letter continues, "This said young lady has of late sent to the princess to tell her to be of good cheer, and that her troubles would sooner come to an end than she supposed, and that when the opportunity occurred, she would show herself her true and devoted servant." The princess, of course, here is referring to Mary Tudor, the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. Now, while this might not have been Jane, Jane Seymour, like I said, really loved Mary. She really cared for Mary. Eustace Shapley was very Catholic and didn't approve a lot of things that were happening in court, so he can be kind of considered an unreliable narrator. But these are some of the only sources that we have to go off of. So it could be that this was Jane Seymour, the Imperial Lady, but most likely it was not. for me, like when I hear Imperial Lady, I think possibly Spanish Lady, which kind of makes sense when you think about how Catherine of Aragon surrounded herself with Catholic Spanish servants. So it could have been like one of Catherine of Aragon's former servants, possibly. But again, like we don't know. We do know that Henry was making a royal progress around England in 1535. And on September 3rd, he was at John Seymour's home at Wolf Hall. And they had intended to be at James Brothers Edward's house in October. But their plan sort of changed and they never actually ended up going. We also know that in January 1536, when Anne Boleyn had her last miscarriage, there was something going on between Jane and Henry. So even if she wasn't the Imperial Lady in 1534, in 1536, there was something going on. Eustace Shapley, in the same letter that he wrote about Anne Boleyn's miscarriage, later on talks about a Mistress Seymour, which is Seymour. There was also talk in this letter about the king looking for another wife. We read the first part last time, so I won't read all of that again, but it was about how Anne had had her miscarriage, and it was far enough along that it was clear that it was a boy, and there were speculations that she blamed it on hearing the news of Henry getting injured at the celebration that he threw for Catherine of Aragon's death. And then the letter continues that it might have been a fear that the king would treat her like the late queen, especially considering the treatment shown to a lady of court named Mistress Seymour, to whom, as many say, has lately made great presents. The princesses Gavarante, her daughters, and a niece, have been in great sorrow for the said abortion, and have been continually questioning a lady who is very intimate with the princess, whether the said princess did not know the sad news of the abortion, and that she might know that. But they could not for the world that she knew the rest, meaning that there was some fear that the king might take another wife. And in this case, of course, abortion does mean miscarriage. They just called it abortion because it was sort of like a spontaneous abortion. I think some doctors will even refer to that the same now. Like if it gets past a certain time period in your pregnancy, it's no longer a miscarriage. It's a spontaneous abortion. But I'm not sure. I'm not a doctor. I'm a historian. So again, this account that I just read is from Eustace Shapley, so we kind of have to take it with a grain of salt, but it sort of aligns with some of the other things that were said during this time as well. But I mean, also those also have to be taken with a grain of salt. Like, for example, Nicholas Sander said right after Anne had her miscarriage that Henry went to check on her and she was, quote, bewailing her mishap and angry at the transference to another the king's affection. She cried out to him, see how well I must be since the day I caught that abandoned woman, Jane, sitting on your knees. But, I mean, if we learned anything from the last episode, Nicholas Sander cannot be trusted. So don't believe that. Really. After Anne's miscarriage, there are some stories that she sort of took notice of this relationship building between Jane and Henry, and that perhaps she retaliated against Jane. It's said that Anne may have struck Jane on multiple occasions for sort of flaunting her relationship with Henry in front of her, but again, we can't know for sure. Don't take a drink every time I say we can't know for sure. I really hope that you haven't been doing that because you will get alcohol poisoning. There's also another story that in March of 1536, Henry gave Jane a locket that had his picture inside. And when Anne saw it, she ripped it off of Jane's neck in anger. And Anne possibly sliced her finger open in the process, which like would have been a sight to see. But she wouldn't have sent her away from court because if you remember that last letter that I was just reading, Jane Boleyn was banished from court for trying to orchestrate removing King Henry's mistress. So she probably would not have tried to remove another one because she's trying to be in good graces with Henry VIII because he's already upset with her about having a miscarriage, you know? So around this time, Eustace Shapley sort of confirms that this relationship was building up. He doesn't say anything about Anne's reaction to it, but he does talk about one instance where Henry had sent Jane a purse full of sovereigns and with it a letter. And that the young lady, after kissing the letter, returned it unopened to the messenger and throwing herself on her knees before him, begged the said messenger that he would pray the king on her part to consider that she was a gentlewoman of good and honorable parents without reproach, and that she had no greater riches in the world than her honor, which she would not injure for a thousand deaths. And that if he wished to make her some present in money, she begged it might be when God enabled her to make some honorable match. And where have we heard this before? So basically, here, Jane could have been pulling an Anne Boleyn, where she rejected the king's advances and in return claimed that she will only accept these things and she will only sleep with him if he will make her his wife. And isn't it fucking convenient that the same month that Henry sent a letter to this woman and she rejected him, saying she'd never be his mistress and only his wife, his actual wife fucked up enough that she was executed the next month? It's almost like Henry had some other motive that may have additionally led to the execution of his wife. I mean, allegedly, of course. This man is garbage. Also allegedly, of course. So I know some people sort of question that if she had been accepting these gifts for the past few months, what is it at this point that sort of makes her change her mind? And it might be that Henry was getting more serious and this was her opportunity to get what she wanted. And in the same letter, Shapley writes about how Henry responded to this. Shapley says that the king's love and desire towards the lady was wonderfully increased and that he said that she had behaved most virtuously, and to show her that he only loved her honorably, he did not intend henceforth to speak with her except in presence of some of her kin, for which reason the king had caused Cromwell to remove from a chamber to which the king can go by certain galleries without being perceived, and has lodged there the eldest brother of the said lady with his wife, in order to bring thither the same young lady. So basically, he moves Cromwell out of an adjoining room that he had with Henry, and he moves Jane's brother, Edward, and Edward's wife into this room so that Henry could sneak back and forth to see Jane. But he was trying to make it seem like he was this super honorable dude who would like only see her when a chaperone was present, because this is what Henry does. If we think about the bonus episode last time with Anne, he speaks in like very flowery language. He speaks very romantically to her because these are the kind of things that would probably woo Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn was known for being kind of a flirt. She was known for being very witty. And so writing these letters, like what he wrote for her, most likely worked for her, but they would not work for Jane. And at the same time that all of this is happening, this is allegedly when Henry is going to Thomas Cromwell and telling him that he needs to find a way to get him out of his marriage to Anne Boleyn. And Thomas starts looking into the stuff with Henry Percy and all of that, which to me just kind of confirms that Anne was like mostly innocent of her charges, except for the dead man's shoes thing. She admitted that she said some of this to her ladies in waiting while she was in the Tower of London. And it's possible, according to like one documentary that I watched, that these ladies in waiting that were attending to her in the Tower of London were actually spies that were appointed there by Thomas Cromwell. And they were like feeding him all of the information of what was happening. And like that was like their smoking gun that they were able to do. So I'm not sure. But it does seem to confirm that Henry was done with his flirtatious wife and was going for the more innocent Jane. But here's the thing. Jane may not have been as innocent as she made herself seem. So later in that same letter, Shapley says that Jane has been well taught for the most part by those intimate with the king who hate the concubine, Anne Boleyn, that she must by no means comply with the king's wishes except by way of marriage, in which she is quite firm. She is also advised to tell the king boldly how his marriage is detested by the people and that none consider it lawful. And then in another letter from later on that month, Shapley talks about how people are counseling Jane and writing to Princess Mary that she again should be in good cheer and that Henry was done with the concubine Anne and that people were saying that she was about to get divorced from him and that he was intending to marry Jane, which again aligns with what was speculated and what was said about this time period. And a lot of people go on to interpret this as Jane was being manipulated and Jane was being coached on what to say and all of this because she was just a weak little submissive girl and like this, that, and the other, whatever. But for me, there's one little 6-word phrase in one of the letters that I just read that makes me think that she was totally okay with this and that she was not being manipulated, that this is what she felt and this is what she wanted. And that little phrase is when the letter says, in which she is quite firm. To me, this means that she agreed with the things that they were saying, which tells me that Jane Seymour was very Catholic still, which is not surprising when you consider how she was raised, how Catholic her family was, when you think about how much she allegedly loved Catherine of Aragon and how much reverence she had for the Princess Mary. And you know, at this point in 1536, the Anglican Church had only really been around for 2 years. So although there were people who were acting like they supported the king in the background, they were really just hoping that they would like get back to how things were. That's also not to say that there weren't people who supported the Protestant Reformation in England. I mean, if Martin Luther is any evidence of that, there were people who did not like the Roman Catholic Church. But you can't just tell people to change their beliefs that they've had for their entire lives that they actually believe in, because one dude says so, regardless if he's a king or not. Like, think about in America, if the president was to tell you to think something different, that's a core foundational value for you, you're not going to think different just because he told you to. You know what I mean? So on May 14th, the day before Anne's trial, Jane was moved closer to Henry within a mile, where she was splendidly served by the king's cook and other officers and was most richly dressed. So like up until before this, she was a little bit farther away, but she would go to visit her brother and then the king would just like appear in the brother's chambers and be like, "Oh, Jane, fancy meeting you here." But right before Anne's trial and her execution and all of that, she was moved closer so that he could just go see her whenever he wanted to. The day that Anne was supposed to be executed, which was May 18th, 1536, Eustace Shapley wrote about the king's new lady, which was Jane. This is where we get the description that he has of Jane, that she was of middling stature and like not a great beauty and all of that. But this letter also shows a little bit of contempt that Shapley had for the English court, which I kind of find funny, because he says, "I leave you to judge whether, being English and having long frequented the court, perhaps the king will only be too glad to be so far relieved from trouble. Also, according to the account given of him by the concubine, he is neither vigor nor virtue, and besides, he may make a condition in the marriage that she be a virgin, and when he has a mind to divorce her, he will find enough of witnesses. The said Seymour is not a woman of great wit, but she may have good understanding. It is said that she inclines to be proud and haughty, but she bears great love and reverence to the princess." So basically he's questioning because like the English court is just so full of like debauchery and flirting that like there's no way that she can actually be a virgin. At this point, Jane is in her mid-20s. She's never been engaged. She's never been married, which is pretty late for this time period. Some historians speculate it's because she wasn't a great beauty or whatever, and because her family couldn't really provide much of a dowry. But there's no evidence that says that she wasn't a virgin, even if there was all of that like flirtation and courtly love. This letter also does like almost comically point out, and this is a point that I think is funny, sort of, in a really like sad sort of way, that Henry will just use whatever excuse he can and lie about things and like scrounge up witnesses to get out of a marriage when he's tired of it. I mean, this is following letters that we spoke about last week that say like, even though that Shapley didn't like Anne Boleyn and didn't like what she allegedly did to the country, because we're just going to blame it all on her, he still didn't think that like she was necessarily treated right, and he thought that a lot of the charges against her were orchestrated to get out of his marriage, even though he was like not heartbroken when she was executed, honestly. And then on the same day, May 18th, Jane and Henry are given permission to marry. Apologies if you can hear any noises in the background. They're doing construction outside of my apartment. Usually I try to record this at nighttime when it's a little bit more quiet. But again, cold brew in a wine glass. So the next day, May 19th, Anne is executed. And then on the 20th, Jane and Henry are officially engaged. When Jane came secretly by the river to the king's lodgings and the betrothal was officially announced, and they were married 10 days later on May 30th, 1536. This may have been the first time that they had sex. There was one documentary that I watched that said that when they were officially betrothed, her coming secretly may have been them, like, you know, having sex for the first time or whatever. But it's not like they recorded these things. But I mean, even if they didn't, Anne's executed on the 19th, they're engaged on the 20th, married on the 30th. Like, was Anne's body even out of rigor mortis yet? And apparently to sort of squash the rumors that he did all of this to Anne just to marry Jane, because people were talking and they didn't like all of this, regardless of their possible personal feelings for Anne. So to squash this, before they got married, he moved her 7 miles away from him and was telling people like, "I have no desire to get married ever again unless my people demand it." But like, bro, you're not fooling anybody. You're going around like griping and complaining that your current wife isn't dead already, and then after her execution, you're partying and living it up, and the moment that you literally hear her head has hit the fucking ground, you're marching straight to your new girlfriend's house and having a special celebratory fucking dinner with her, and you're walking around with your own fucking theme song. Literally. Shapui writes that people with instruments are just following him around and playing music and singing at all times because he's just so happy that he needs his own fucking theme song as he's walking around. And on the day of your wife's execution, you're wearing white instead of the mourning color of black and writing little like silly rhymes about how happy you are and being so happy that you can go back to writing these silly little rhymes because Anne Boleyn and her brother George used to make fun of you for them. Like, did you think that people would just forget this treatment of your wife and that people would just like believe you when you're saying you never want to get married again when less than 2 weeks later you get married? Like, yeah, it was a small private ceremony, but people fucking knew. And even if they didn't know on the 30th when you got married, she was acknowledged as queen on June 4th of 1536. People fucking knew. But even before Anne's death and their marriage, Jane was already scheming. She was already trying to like test her persuasion over Henry and seeing what she could do. Eustace Shapley was essentially like live tweeting on the day of Anne's execution. He wrote a ton of letters back to back, and he wrote about how they hoped that Anne's execution meant that normalcy will be restored and that this whole thing would just be like a blip and Princess Mary would be acknowledged again because, you know, when the Acts of Supremacy and all that were passed in 1534. And like, actually, like even before that, when Catherine and Henry's marriage was deemed illegitimate, Mary was considered a bastard and she wasn't acknowledged anymore. And then after this, writing in the letter, Eustace Shapley writes about how Jane is talking to Henry and trying to convince him to acknowledge Mary again. And Shapley wrote that the king told her she was a fool and ought to solicit the advancement of the children that they would have between them and not any others. She replied that in asking for the restoration of the princess, she conceived that she was seeking the rest and tranquility of the king, herself, and her future children in the whole realm. For without that, neither your majesty nor his people will ever be content. I will endeavor by all means to make her continue in this vein. But even though he's telling her, like, dude, don't worry about that. You should worry about the kids that we're going to have and not, like, my kids that already exist that have already been unacknowledged and, like, fucking abandoned or whatever. She doesn't give this up. And about a month after she's announced as queen on July 6, 1536, Henry meets with Mary due to Jane's, like, prodding and convincing and pushing. And this is the first time that he's seen his daughter in 5 years. It was said that Jane treated Mary as if she were her own daughter, which is interesting considering that she's only like a few years older than Mary at this point. But apparently he was really happy about this. But for Mary, it was actually sort of tragic because the only way that this could happen was by acknowledging wholeheartedly that her father was the head of the church and that she was a bastard and that her parents' marriage was never legal. And because she pretty much had to, like, Henry was threatening to have her executed if she didn't agree, and Anne's blood was probably like still staining the fucking scaffold. On July 22nd, she signed an oath that said that she agreed to this, that she wouldn't be an heir, but at least she was back in Henry's good graces and she was allowed back in court. She became a lady in waiting to Queen Jane, and maybe he'd like reconsider the whole heir thing later on. But it would just kept running through his mind that like he didn't have a son. He didn't have a son. He didn't have son. Well, he didn't have a legitimate one. He did have Henry Fitzroy, who was his illegitimate son with Bessie Blount. And apparently he was thinking about legitimizing Henry Fitzroy because at this point, Henry VIII was in his mid-40s and the life expectancy at this time was like 50-ish. And Henry was old at 44. It's not like it is today where at 44, you still have like half of your life. You're having your midlife crisis at 44. At 44, this was like pretty much getting to the end of your life at this point. And if he didn't have a son with Jane immediately, most likely the Tudor line would die in only 2 generations because, you know, we can't have a woman rule. And around this time, he apparently made a comment to Thomas Cromwell that he felt himself growing old and he doubted that he would have any more children with Jane whatsoever. There also goes into the fact that like Anne Boleyn had said that after his accident in January 1536, earlier that year, that he was having impotency issues. So maybe that was also why he was doubting if he would ever have any more children. Cause like homeboy just like couldn't get it up, which happens to some people in your 40s. It's totally natural. It's what the blue pill is for and all of that. But the day after this oath was signed by Mary, that she acknowledged that she was a bastard and that she wasn't going to be an heir to the throne and all of that, Henry Fitzroy died. And Henry was devastated because now he had no sons whatsoever, not even illegitimate ones. He had two daughters that weren't acknowledged. Because remember, like, Elizabeth is still around at this point too. She was probably about four at this time and was practically abandoned by Henry to the point where, like, Mary, who resented and hated Elizabeth for just what she stood for, pitied Elizabeth and had to step forward to advocate for her because Elizabeth was a toddler and was not guaranteed food. Her servants had to hunt for anything that they would eat, and she didn't even have clothes that would fit her. So later on in October of 1536, roundabouts, there was this uprising that became known as the Pilgrimage of Grace. So during the Pilgrimage of Grace, some northern counties of England started revolting in response to the Protestant Reformation, and Henry and Cromwell were attempting to, like, push their government control farther and dissolve some of the monasteries, and people just did not like this. In Yorkshire, there was an uprising of over 30,000 people whose demands partially included England becoming a Catholic state again and to have a parliament that was separate from royal influence. When Eustace Shapley wrote about this, he was saying that people were so angry with the king that they might have, like, a regicide situation on their hands, which Shapley was like, it's not the worst thing that could happen because he could probably, like, somehow get Mary on the throne as the oldest surviving child of Henry VIII. Like, you know, they could probably make that happen. But he wrote that Jane threw herself on her knees in front of the king and said to him that perhaps God had permitted this rebellion for ruining so many churches. And she begged him to restore the abbeys, to which he replied by telling her to attend to other things, reminding her that the last queen had died in consequence of meddling too much with state affairs. He is so much garbage. So much garbage. I hate Henry VIII more and more as I research these fucking stories. So the Pilgrimage of Grace didn't really achieve anything. Like, no other parts of the country really got involved. About 250 men, give or take, were executed. But Jane sort of showed her hand that she may be Catholic, or at least, like, a Catholic sympathizer. And this was the month that she was supposed to be coronated as queen. But it was postponed and was continuously postponed, probably because Henry wanted to see if she was worth it. Meaning, would you give me what I want? But she redeemed herself a few months later, most likely around December or January, when she got pregnant and Henry was ecstatic. So not much is written about her that I could find during her pregnancy. But in September of 1537, she moved to Hampton Court to go into her confinement before she gave birth. This was just, like, a custom. Women would go into isolation to kind of help reduce stress and make sure that everyone was ready whenever she eventually went into labor. And one of the people that accompanied her was Mary Tudor. So Jane went into labor on October 9th of 1537. Henry was very excited. He prepared for all of the ceremonies and celebrations, including gun salutes and food and wine and, like, bonfires and all of that stuff. That's just this grand thing that you do when a son is born, right? But the 9th came and went, and then another day came and went, and Jane was in labor for 2 days and three nights until the 12th, when at 2 a.m, Jane, exhausted and probably in excruciating pain and probably barely hanging on, finally gave birth to her son, Edward. But this wasn't good enough for Henry because, like, what happened with him, he needed a spare son. And he was never meant to be king, and it was, like, just so happened that it was lucky that Henry VII had more than one son. So Henry was very happy. He called Jane his true love and his true wife at this point, and then was like, as soon as possible, I'm getting you pregnant again. But this wasn't going to happen. She wasn't in good condition after this, like, unsurprisingly. She emerged a few days later, but she was regarded as being even more pale and even weaker than she typically appeared. 3 days after his birth, on October 15th, Edward was christened, and she attended and received visitors and seemed like she was okay and, like, on the up and up, just slowly recovering because it was such a traumatic birth for her. But 2 days after Edward's christening, on October 17th, she came down with a very high fever, and over the next week, her condition did not improve. And on October 24th, 1537, Jane died. Most historians say that she died of childbed fever. So this is a term used for an infection that arises after childbirth, possibly from using like unsterilized equipment, or perhaps there was a piece of placenta that was left behind because it was such a traumatic birth that perhaps she didn't get everything out that needed to come out. There are even some records that say in her recovery, she was asking for really strange foods. So maybe it didn't have anything to do with childbirth at all. And maybe it was food poisoning and her body was so weak from giving birth that it couldn't fight this infection that was building. But there is this widespread story that maybe it was something else. Could Jane have died from a botched C-section? So here's the story. Jane has been in labor for a couple days at this point, and it's starting to look grim. So the doctors go to Henry VIII and ask him if their efforts become life-saving, and they can only save either Jane or the unborn baby, which would Henry save? This is an impossible decision, right? Story says that he didn't find it that impossible, though, and he chooses the child because he can find another wife, but this might be his only chance for a son, and he needs a son, damn it. So the surgeons performed a C-section, and as a result, the queen soon died. So there are a lot of people who believe this, but it isn't true. Not because C-sections didn't happen, that's like the whole twist ending of Macbeth after all, but until the mid-1800s, they were fatal to the mother and only really performed when the mother was dead or was for sure dying and they needed to remove the baby. And in those cases, the C-section would kill her. But again, this isn't what happened with Jane. So let's go into this a little bit. This account was written by, drumroll please, terrible drumroll, our favorite propagandist, Nicholas Sander. So if you need a reminder, Nicholas Sander was a Catholic in exile during the reign of Elizabeth I, who wrote a book called The Rise and Growth of the Anglican Schism. This is a book where he wrote that Anne was deformed and had six fingers and that she committed incest with her brother and gave birth to a deformed fetus and all that jazz. So there were a lot of people who have read this book and don't know that it's propaganda and think that because it's a historical account that it's true, and don't realize like how much propaganda is in history and how you have to like really sort through everything to find the truth. There are others who are in the same or similar position as Sander who did the same, like Nicholas Harpsfield, who said that Edward was born by gnawing out the mother's womb. He was writing during Queen Mary I with the same intention to make Henry look bad because Harpsfield was a Catholic. And by, you know, this story of sacrificing the mother so his king should be born, so his son should be born, this makes him look like a monster a little bit, right? And then there was another account that was written by someone who was anonymous, but this was written in Spanish, which leads one to believe that this person was Catholic. And their work became known as the Spanish Chronicle. And they wrote that it was that the mother had to be sacrificed for the child. Then they do say, though, I do not affirm this to be true, only that it was rumored. So they admit that it might not have been the case, but it's what people were saying. But contemporary historians and historians writing in the 1600s said that that wasn't the case. Most people reported a regular birth, that she even signed a document following the delivery, which wouldn't have happened if she was like sacrificed for the baby. She also wouldn't have been able to meet with people on the 15th of October when Edward was christened. Maybe if there was like some reference to her being cut and this leading to her death, like maybe it was like an episiotomy, for anyone who doesn't know what that is. That's when like they make a decision at the vaginal canal to make it larger to help the baby pass through. But I don't know if they did that back then. A quick Google search says that that only dates back about 300 years, which would have been like long after Jane's delivery. I mean, it would certainly account for an infection, but it was not a C-section gone wrong. Jane was the only queen of King Henry to die as queen, so she was given a grand ceremony and a queen's burial. There were 29 women who marched with her as mourners, which is why it's believed that she was 29 and most likely born between October 1507 to October 1508. And at her funeral, Mary was the chief mourner for her. She was buried at Windsor. And when Henry died, he was buried next to her. Mary, in addition to being the chief mourner, was also appointed as Edward's godmother as well. When Henry married his sixth wife, Catherine Parr, he had a portrait painted of him and his children that's known as the family portrait. But instead of Catherine next to him, where the queen would stand, it's Jane. He called her the love of his life. Now, whether this was true or just because she gave him what he wanted, which was a son, that in his mind, she almost sacrificed herself for this, although not through C-section, or if it was just because he didn't have time to grow to despise her as he did his other wives, we'll never know. I think she died at like the height of his affection for her because he was given what he wanted by her. And I think that might honestly be why, in my opinion. So that's the story of Jane Seymour, third wife of Henry VIII and Queen Consort for about 17 months. So I said I had thoughts about her, right? So within my rabbit holes, I also fell into this like thought black hole of what would have happened if she hadn't died. So in my opinion, and this is my opinion because there's very little written about her, nothing was written by her. There's so much propaganda surrounding the wives of Henry VIII. So it's hard to know for sure, I think. And this might not be agreed upon by other historians, but in doing the research that I have done in this limited amount of time that I have researched her, in my opinion, I think she was very Catholic and she didn't like where the country was going. She didn't like how Catherine was treated. And when Henry started his affections for her, she, having been in court and one of the ladies of Anne Boleyn, used the same strategy that Anne Boleyn used. She accepted the gifts, she accepted the praise, she built up the affections of Henry. And when he dropped the proposal of, will you be my mistress? Do you want to fuck me? She rejected him, saying, I'll only have sex with you if we can get married. While a lot of people think that Anne Boleyn did this out of like manipulation, Jane painted it as because she was so pure and because she was so godly of a woman. But it seems, at least from like the accounts of Eustace Shapley, that she was conspiring with Catholics and Catholic sympathizers who were close to the king, people who knew how to get to the king, people who knew what the king was like and what would convince him to go the routes that he went. You know, perhaps she thought that this was how she would bring England back to the Roman Catholic Church. Maybe this was looked at as like a divine duty of hers. Maybe this was like Joan of Arc for her, you know, like God coming to her and telling her, this is your job, this is your duty, this is your destiny. I mean, even her crest and motto may signify this, right? It's the phoenix, the resurrection, the return to old forms, to shrug off these things that don't serve you anymore. And through our marriage, I will bring the resurrection back to Catholicism. The phoenix is rising out of a castle, meaning that the phoenix will restore the castle back to its old forms, possibly. My opinion. So what did she do to do this? She made herself out to be the opposite of Henry's other wives. Because like we talked about in the last episode, the things that Henry loves about his wives at the beginning are the things that he eventually grows to hate. So Catherine, who was strong and confident and forthright in her opinions, and was like a badass warrior bitch queen, he grows to hate her for it. And Anne, who is this flirtatious, outspoken woman who's involved in political matters, leads to her being hated. So she made herself the opposite. Jane made herself soft-spoken. Jane made herself meek. She made herself submissive and subservient and virtuous. She even took this and put it into her motto. Now, she may have actually been like this. She is described as being kind and virtuous and all of this in her childhood, but those sources might not have been contemporary. Those sources might be from later on when people look back on her, how she was portrayed when she was queen, and say, oh, well, she was, you know, virtuous and kind and honorable and all of this as queen, then that's most likely how she was as a child, right? It was never expected for a woman who is like noble, but not like noble, to be a queen. She was never expected to reach such a high standard. She was in her mid-20s and hadn't even been engaged. And here you have the King of England standing before you, who viciously divorced his first wife, and here's his opportunity. So maybe she was submissive, maybe she was virtuous, maybe she was a godly woman, or maybe she was just really good at painting herself to appear that way. And I think her focusing so much on restoring Mary and making good graces with Mary when Henry had another daughter. She wasn't arguing for him to make good graces with his daughters, both of them, just the Catholic one. Maybe perhaps this was Jane's attempt to see how much sway she had over Henry VIII. Maybe by seeing if she could restore the relationship between King Henry VIII and his Catholic daughter, Mary, that this was just like a test run into restoring Henry's relationship with the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope. And when she had a son, when she gave Henry what he truly wanted, which was a male heir to the throne, I think she could have gotten whatever the fuck she wanted. I think she could have used the fact that she was the mother of the Prince of England or the Prince of Wales, whatever you want to call him, to sway Henry to at least consider meeting with the Pope, to at least open his mind to a meeting of some sort. And perhaps if something like that were to happen, I just wonder what England would be like today. And like, this is where I really fall down like a black hole of like alternate reality almost. I mean, that's not to say there weren't people who disagree with the Roman Catholic Church. And that's not to say that these people who disagreed would not have tried to break from the Roman Catholic Church following Martin Luther's example and all of that. But if England was a Catholic state and no longer a Protestant state, then these people would have most likely been in the minority and not the majority. Or there would have been like a religious civil war that happened a lot sooner into the 1500s. If Jane would have lived, Catherine Howard would not have been executed, most likely. Lady Jane Grey would not have been executed. Some of the laws that were passed in the later times of Henry's reign would not have been passed. Maybe there wouldn't have been so much fighting between England and Spain if they had went back to being a Catholic state. I mean, that's a big part of Elizabeth I's rule, is this fighting constantly with Spain and England. Mary would not have had to take the throne because she would have been an heir. This may have led to her executing a lot less people. We're going to talk about her in a few episodes, but her nickname was Bloody Mary because she executed so many Protestants because she was trying to transform England back into a Catholic state. But at this point, so much time had passed that England didn't want to be a Catholic state, that there were people who were just like holding on to this Protestantism so much because it made sense at that point. But when Jane Seymour died, the Anglican Church had only been around for a couple years. It possibly could even go to my area of research, which is the history of witchcraft, and say that if she would have lived and she would have helped restore England back to a Catholic state, it may have prevented some of the witch trials from happening in the late 1500s and into the 1600s. A lot of historians believe that the beginning of the witch trials in England have their roots in the fight between the Catholics and the Protestants, that the Protestants, who were in the majority at this point, were trying to squash out the Catholics by saying that their practices that they were doing were magical, that they could like just pray over some water and now this water becomes magic water, or like holy water, whatever you want to call it. That they had dominion over demons, that they could expel them whenever they needed to, that they could just say some words and bless a house and rid it of all these things, where the Catholics are then saying in return that by the Protestants not doing this, they were heretics. And they were like this, that, and the other. So there are historians who believe that the witchcraft trials began as a religious dispute. But I mean, of course, we'll never know because she did die. But it's very interesting to kind of go through this rabbit hole of like alternate reality and think, what if? How this queen, who's largely overlooked, and this queen who's noted mostly as the queen of Henry VIII, who died in the process of giving him a son, someone who is not important, someone who did not have an impact on anything. It's interesting to think about what kind of impact she could have had, because she did have an impact on Henry VIII. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, please consider subscribing or leaving a review or joining my Patreon. You'll have access to lots of fun perks if you do so. And remember, friends, history may be watching you, so don't fuck it up. And remember that Nicholas Sander was a dirty, dirty liar, and he is the nastiest skank bitch I have ever met. Do not trust him. He is a fugly slut. Sorry, I was watching Mean Girls earlier, but I feel like this applies to him. Anyway, bye!